Welcome to another episode of Sharing the Hope from the Mike and Mason Foundation. I'm your host, Patrick Mason, and today we're joined by Tyler Sajak.
Shydock.
Totally wrong. And it's okay. I get them all wrong, so I apologize.
It's a hard name.
I can mess up my own name. Don't worry. The first question I typically ask is, how did you become interested in the HLHS problem? But I think we're going to get to that pretty quickly reading your bio. So Tyler Shydock is a 30-year-old HLHS patient. He had 3 open heart surgeries at Mott Children's Hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan. His family moved to Iowa when he was 3, and he began seeing a cardiology team at what is now Children's Nebraska in Omaha. He grew up involved in as many sports as he could play, eventually lettering in tennis in high school and playing baseball through his sophomore year and performing in the band and the forensics team. He graduated from Calvin University in Grand Rapids, Michigan in 2016 with a degree in political science. In 2018, he met the group that would found Single Ventricle Patient Day at the NPC-QIC/FON fall learning session that year. He has been helping plan SVPD since then. Tyler is currently getting his master's degree from the University of Pittsburgh in higher education and is working for the University of Pittsburgh's Physician Assistant Program as an academic advisor. So welcome to the show, Tyler.
Thank you for having me. Look forward to being on here.
It's great having you. You are our first patient that we're getting to interview, which is wonderful. And I'm very, very interested to hear your story.
I hope to set the standard high.
Yeah. The first question I've got then is not so much how did you become interested in the single ventricle condition. It's tell us about, you know, your condition, your experience, and how your understanding of it changed as you grew up.
Yeah, so as long as I can remember, I know that I've had something wrong with my heart. It was very apparent. A couple times a year, you go to see a doctor, and they check your heart. They'd make sure, you know, everything was working okay. And none of my other friends would have this experience. They would never go see a doctor regularly. So I always knew there was something different about me. And once I got to this school age, it started being more of a prominence in my life, recognizing the differences between my energy levels and my friends' energy levels. Things like that, where you would kind of compare and contrast, you know, how fast you can run and how far you can run and things like that, you know, because I was a very competitive kid and I always wanted to keep up. So, yeah, throughout my life, I always kind of knew. But as I got older, my parents wanted me to be able to take care of myself eventually. And so as I got older and older, they gave me more responsibility as far as making appointments and knowing what my medications were and what my heart defect was. That by the time I got old enough to go to college, I could handle it all on my own without having to worry about calling them about, hey, what medication do I take, or what can I take? Can I take Tylenol? Can I take aspirin? Like, what's the deal here with these medications that, you know, some of us take regularly and some of us can't because of other medications and complications and things like that. So yeah, it was always kind of a process of, as I got older, getting to know more and more about my own condition and how I interact with the world with it.
How did that go, I think, with your cardiologist, maybe your team of doctors? How did that transition work between your parents and yourself?
I think it went pretty well for the most part. There were obviously hiccups with every doctor-patient relationship. But as far as like them understanding that they want me to learn about it, when I was young, the doctor talked to my parents exclusively because I couldn't understand what was going on. But as I got older, they would say, talk to Tyler more since he's the one dealing with this every day. So it slowly kind of transitioned to talking to my parents from exclusively to talking to me exclusively and kind of including my parents in the conversation as it went along. And the doctor understood that they wanted me to be able to take care of myself as well. And it wasn't any use to me if I didn't know what I had, what my medications were.
Yeah, that's a good point. You just suddenly get cast out on your own and not know what you're supposed to know and supposed to do.
Yeah.
That's good. Have you changed cardiologists as you've gotten older?
So I changed from Michigan when I was first there when I was born to Omaha. Then I changed from Omaha back to Michigan. Omaha was all a pediatric cardiologist. I transferred back to Michigan. It was adult. And when I moved to Pittsburgh to get my master's degree and my job, I transitioned to an adult cardiologist in Pittsburgh as well.
Okay. And what was your experience dealing with adult cardiologists? Like, did you basically have to train them on your condition, or how was their knowledge level?
My main cardiologist that always is known, they'd all started pediatric cardiologists originally and kind of transitioned with the kids as they got older, you know, because I'm on the older end of the spectrum of people with my condition and similar conditions. So there wasn't a whole lot of options for adult cardiologists up until I was, you know, 20-ish. But if I were to like walk into a regular hospital and talk to a regular cardiologist, they would have no idea what was going on just because they normally deal with heart attacks and strokes and things like that. So I've had that experience before walking into ERs. One time in college, I was having chest pains because I had ran with a backpack that was too heavy. And so I pulled a muscle in my chest was the result. But I went to the ER, the main children's ER, and said I need to see a doctor. And they said, how old are you? And I said, I'm 20, 21, something like that at the time. And they said, you're too old for the children's hospital. You have to go to the regular hospital. You have like a heart issue. You have to go to the regular cardiologist. So I got to the adult hospital and they took one look at me and said, you should be at the children's hospital. I was like, I told you.
Yeah. It's like, I'm here because I know how this is going to go down. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm laughing.
It's a funny story. Like, it had it been like something serious, it wouldn't be as funny. But having it be end up being a pulled muscle makes it more funny.
How did you end up hearing about or becoming involved in NPC QIC / FON?
Yeah, so there's a nurse I had. Actually, she likes to tell people that she knew me since before I was born. And so I'm a newer in Michigan, and then we moved back to Michigan when I was graduated high school, moving into college. We got reconnected. That would have been 2012-ish when we moved back. In 2018, she wanted me to do a video for the NPC QIC FON foldering session. And so I went down to Chicago there for that day and presented the video and all that. And Gwen, the nurse, knows like everybody at these things. So she's going around introducing me to everybody, every single person that she knows. And I came across Tom Glenn, who is now a cardiologist at Texas Children's, and Meg Didier and Alicia Wilmoth. And we all got together on that Saturday and said, we need to do something for patients because this is all oriented to doctors, which is great. Like, we need to learn too. But it'd be great if there were things for patients to do too. So the following year, we had the first single ventricle patient day, and we had about 30-ish people for that event.
How did that idea come about?
We just kind of started talking in that conversation. We're like, you know, this is great that there's doctors getting together like twice a year and all the different conferences that they go to. It'd be great for something to like that patients could go to and learn patient stuff, as opposed to like how doctors are treating things for little kids, especially for those of us that are adults now that are like, it's great that they're doing better with little kids, but there's nothing for us adults now. You know, we're starting to get issues with livers and things like that. It'd be nice if we could advocate for ourselves and get to know each other, because there were a lot of us that hadn't met people like us until at least our 20s. I think I would have been 25 at that point when I first met Tom and Meg and Alicia, and they were the first people that I knew that were similar in age to me that had heart defects.
From your perspective, what does NPC QIC and FON kind of mean to you?
To me, I think they're a way for families and patients to learn more about the conditions. NPC kind of focuses more on the inner stage prior to the FONTAN, which is great. Like, we need lots of people focusing on that. FON is more our speed, where it's like post-FONTAN, what's happening to these kids as they become adults. So FON, I have more of a connection with FON personally, just because it's more of like, this is what we're going through now, as opposed to like, we've already been through the interstage stuff. But yeah, it's a wonderful organization, wonderful people involved. everybody I've met that's a part of it has been great and very welcoming of me and of our team and our ideas. I mean, being able to be involved with both Single Venture Incubation Day and now being on the planning committee for the MPC QIC Fawn Learning Session for both fall and spring is a great opportunity for me to advocate for patients on those panels and those groups.
Yeah, we me and my wife attended in 2017 when it was in Cincinnati because it was just MPC QIC in those days because we had family there. It was easy. We were there already. Yeah. Yeah. It was like, oh, hey, this is happening. We should go. And I remember at that time, you know, they were just starting to talk about what they were calling phase three, which was the beyond first year stuff. And then eventually Fawn started sort of separately and just kind of, they seemed to be coming in, you know, what was the, I'm going to call it the secret theme from the last learning session, but it was, you know, one organization.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, you know, fine for me. I'm a, you know, a nerd at heart. And from a data perspective, that's kind of what you want is just one seamless data stream. So,
yeah.
Okay. Tell us about what Single Ventricle Day is, what it consists of. Like, what if somebody were to go, what would they experience?
Yeah. So, Single Ventricle Patient Day is a day during the MPC QIC full learning session. It's normally a Saturday, the Saturday of that weekend. It's a day for patients that are 14 and up to kind of get together, meet some more people that are similar to them. It's a day for us to learn about things like how to deal with relationships, how our liver is affecting us, what our anatomy looks like. We've done panels on lots of different topics from relationships and livers, and we've invited speakers to come. We've had doctors talk about mental health. We've had doctors come and talk about liver function and heart function and transplant teams and things like that. Kind of things that us adults are seeing more and more of, the things we're focusing on. And just trying to build a community of people that we can count on who understand what we're going through with each day.
Yeah. You say 14 and up. Where did that number come from?
Yeah, so we debated about that for quite a while for the first couple, and we're still debating it actually, whether we should lower it or make it higher. 14, we figure these kids are becoming high schoolers. They're kind of starting to take their own path in life. And we kind of want to give them the ability to learn from us as well as learn about what might happen in the future and what they need to look out for. We know that we sometimes talk about some adult topics, so we don't want to make the age too young. We kind of found a kind of a sweet spot. 14 is what we say for the bottom age limit, but there's no upper age limit. We've had people in at least their 40s attend. It's amazing to say that there's people in their 40s with heart conditions like ours.
I fully agree. So, okay. So I guess that's the question, like as a, you know, cause at 14 is sort of one of those big break points, you know, going to high school, it's a whole new sort of experience. And do you get a lot of pushback from parents? Hey, I don't know if I want my 15-year-old in there without me, kind of a deal.
We get a lot of parents that want to come along with especially the younger kids. We, as best we can, put on the website, do not come if you're a parent. This is not for you. This is for your kid. This is for the patients only. So we're kind of trying to advertise that as big as we can, because there are certain things that we'll talk about that either our parents don't know about, or they don't know the extent of it, or they would want to interject their own thoughts. And it's like, we don't want the parents' thoughts. We want the patient's thoughts. Not that we don't respect parents, because parents do a wonderful job with raising their kids and dealing with all the stuff that comes along with a heart defect in one of their kids. But it's just a time for patients to let off the shackles a bit, become themselves, and learn to grow into who they're going to become without having to worry about what they're saying and what their parents are hearing.
Okay. As far as attendees, it's just the people with single ventricle condition. And then panelists might be from different doctors or...
Yeah, all the attendees are single ventricle patients, and the panelists are either single ventricle patients or doctors. We've had some parents on panels before. My dad was on a panel last year about exercise. So we've had parents be panelists. We've had lots of people on panels, but the attendees are all patients. except for this year was the first session we did jointly with doctors and patients to try to get us to learn from each other a bit more. You know, because being in two separate rooms all the time is helpful for some to some extent, but it's not communicating what we yet want communicated always. So we're trying to hopefully next year we'll have a bigger presence between doctors and patients during that session.
That'd be good. Yeah, I've noticed over the years, it seems like the learning session has become more and more. And I want to say this year, it seemed like it was about half and half doctors and nurses, medical professionals, and half parents or patients. That's really awesome from my perspective. Yeah. I like the collaborative model, right? And we've gone from, you know, kind of a two-pronged, you know, medical professionals and parents to now we've got like a triangle where you have the patients in there. And I think a lot of really good stuff will come out of that because just watching the tube weaning stuff has been a phenomenal movement that the medical community didn't really understand how important it was until they got enough parents in the room, like telling them constantly, like this is, and having as a parent who went through it, I can tell you it's the life was night and day. And I am absolutely certain there's stuff going on in y'all's lives that is the same way that the medical folks just don't understand how important it is to your day to day.
Yeah.
So that's very, very heartening to hear.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see parents come to these things too, because, you know, parents are just as involved or more involved than the doctors are with the lives of their kids. And for the parents to learn all they can about what's happening, both in the research and in the day-to-day life, it's just wonderful to see parents take an active role in this stuff.
You know, and I'm sure there's like you're saying, there's a piece of it where there is stuff patients wouldn't necessarily want to voice around their own parents, but would want their parents to know. And so at that point, the medical folks are kind of acting as an intermediary, but that's okay. Like if you can, as long as you get it across, right?
Good.
So what is sort of the hope for, and I keep calling it just single ventricle patient day. What is your hope for that kind of in the short term? I know I say short term, it's been going for 5 years now.
Yes, it's the fifth year.
Yeah. So, you know, kind of the short term, maybe over the next couple of years. And then sort of the long term, what's sort of the vision?
Yeah. So we kind of want to make it into a countrywide, if not international, event. We've had people from across the globe Skype in or Zoom in, whatever platform it's on these days, into the event and pay attention. You know, we had people from Australia to Ireland to India on Zoom during these patient day events. But we also kind of want to make an opportunity for hospitals to build more community among patients. One of the things you've talked about wanted to do this year, but because of the time crunch with everything being moved up, we want to do watch parties. So that each hospital would rent a room or whatever and say to all their patients in the area, hey, we're having a single ventricle patient day watch party. So if you can't afford to go to a single ventricle patient day, you can at least come into our hospital and watch with other patients and be involved that way. Because one of the things you've learned going through this is the virtual event. It's nice to have a virtual option, but there's nobody there to talk to. Then it doesn't really, you can't really bounce ideas off yourself. You know, but if you have a community of 10, 15 patients at a hospital like Michigan or Stanford or Children's LA, one of these bigger hospitals, where you can build community among the patients and the families, you have a lot better community reach with not only your hospital, but also with the people involved, with the patients and parents there. So we kind of want to make it into a community event as well.
That's a really cool idea. You know, it sort of reminds me of how the Children's Heart Foundation sort of runs how their stuff works, because they have sort of a national organization, but most of the real legwork is done by local chapters with the local group, right? And that'd be kind of phenomenal if, you know, because let's face it, you know, flying halfway across the country is not cheap anymore.
Staying in hotels are not cheap either.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a low cost option to get community together would be a wonderful thing if we can bring it to fruition next year or in the coming years.
Yeah, it'd be great. I'm just thinking, sorry. I'm in like brainstorming mode. Like it'd be cool if you could work out with like, because a lot of hospitals have built-in conference room space and stuff.
Yeah.
But so do a lot of like the Ronald McDonald houses and some of the other, and most hospitals are inside cities. So
yeah. And you bring pizza and soda and right. kids will come.
Yeah. That's a, you know, free food, you know, lunch and dinner or maybe breakfast yeah. and lunch, you know,
depending on the time zone. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that'd be great. Everybody watch the, you know, videos, you have the team time. NBC tried to do that during the pandemic with, you know, the concept of the virtual meeting. And I know we still do that in the spring where you have, you know, you're supposed to meet up with your local team. That didn't work during COVID because nobody could meet up. But now, like, you could do it. You could all meet up at the hospital and watch it and actually do team time.
Yeah.
Great idea. I love it.
Yeah. It's not my idea, but it's our group idea.
So you're on the planning committee for the learning sessions now.
Yes, both patient day and learning session.
Okay. Is that your role on the planning committee, or are you doing other stuff?
So I'm the patient representative on the planning committee. So I kind of talk for the patients what we want to see. This year, I brought a couple doctors into the learning session that wouldn't have otherwise come. I don't want to take too much credit for the things I do because I don't think I do that much, but they seem to enjoy having me on the team.
Yeah, I have a feeling you probably do more than you think you do. At least that's what I found.
Yeah.
Do you see single ventricle patient day maintaining its connection to NPC-QIC-FON? Do you see that relationship evolving over time, maybe becoming a separate entity of its own, or?
As far as I can tell, you know, I don't have a vision of the future that far in advance, but I think it'll probably keep it the same, at least same weekend and same venue as the NPC-QIC-FON fall learning session. It makes the most sense that way, I think, to have something built in where doctors are already coming. And if you want to get doctors and patients together, that's kind of the place to do it. When they're all thinking about all the same stuff. So I think the same weekend for sure it'll be in the same venue. Whether or not we'll keep getting funding from FON is up for debate. But I'm sure we'll keep it the same weekend.
Is there anything else about the work you're doing with single ventricle patient day or with FON and NPC-QIC you want to talk about?
Just kind of get the word out about it early. Next year, I don't think they've announced when it'll be yet for next year. But that'll be coming soon, I think. So I'd be on the lookout for that on social media and your hospitals, places that you go for information like that. I would assume it's going to be Chicago again, but I'm not sure.
I've been advocating for Dallas just because it's where I live. It's in the middle of the country. It's cheaper than Chicago.
Nobody wants to go to Chicago in November.
And that's the other thing. It's
a lot warmer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just keep on the lookout for next year's event. We'd love to have patients join, love to have parents come along for the weekend or join virtually as well. That's always an option too. That we're kind of planning on keeping as far as I can advocate for it. Because it's a great option, especially if we can get hospitals into to watch parties, things like that. So yeah, be on the lookout for announcements of when it'll be next year and sign up when you can.
Good deal. Final question I typically ask. So you're in Pittsburgh now?
I am in Pittsburgh now, yes.
Okay, if I find myself in Pittsburgh, in Steelers country, where do I have to go eat? Like, what's the best place to go eat something if I'm in Pittsburgh?
I think the standard Pittsburgh eating place would be Pirandi's. It's a sandwich shop, deli meats, and but they put like two big pieces of bread on top and bottom, and then they put like lots of meat and coleslaw and fries all in the sandwich.
Huh.
So it's like, yeah, like that big.
Yeah, I mean, I like, how do you eat that?
Eat it all at once.
Just squish it all down.
Yeah, it's kind of squish it all down. Whatever falls out, you pick up later.
Okay. Gotcha.
but that's probably the standard fare. But there's also pierogies at lots of places. You can find good food in Pittsburgh. It's not very hard.
Okay. I think when you think, when most people think about Pennsylvania for food stuff, they think Philadelphia and like cheesesteaks and that. And so yeah.
I've had some. It's okay.
Good. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate you being on the show.
You're welcome. Anytime.
I'm sure I'm going to have you on again and get an update about what's going on.
Sounds good.
Thank you again, dear listener, for joining us for this episode of Sharing the Hope from the Micah Mason Foundation, our discussion with Tyler Shydock. If you'd like to find out more about the Fontan Outcomes Network, go to fontanoutcomesnetwork.org and check out the Single Ventricle Day in the next upcoming session. If you'd like to support the podcast, head on over to micahmasonfoundation.org and click on the donate button. I've been your host, Patrick Mason, and this has been Sharing the Hope.